patients, families, providers, and systems in transitioning youth with special health care needs to adult-focused care. Thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you for the opportunity. I always joke that my my field as an internist and pediatrician is I care for people from diaper to depends. More importantly, the panelists, if it wasn't for the work that has been done by these groups of individuals, I would be probably working on cancer research instead. It's been a wonderful phenomenon the last 30 years to see children's special health care needs advancements and grow. Just as a disclosure, I have no financial disclosures. It's really nice at APHA, as compared to the clinical meetings, they don't hound you for disclosures, which means you guys are way more honest and have more personal integrity than the clinicians. So I'm preaching to the choir in this particular room, but as an overview, let me just start that we're going to do a background on transitions for children's special health care needs from pediatric to adult-focused care. And then we're going to go into challenges of transitions, specifically looking at patient, parent, provider, system, and policies, and then going over to the next steps needed to improve the transition process. So, as you know, medical technologies have really improved significantly, and children's special health care needs are just living longer. And subsequently, chronic conditions in childhood are increasingly prevalent, where you have about 16 to 31% who have at least one chronic illness, with 2 to 7% having serious disability. And as our colleague from the Montreal Times had noted, that at least in the United States, greater than 90% of children born today with severe chronic medical conditions will live to adulthood. For instance, in cystic fibrosis, the median age of death was 7, not but 20 years ago. It is now a median age at 40. For type 1 diabetes, also lethal in childhood, we can now expect normal life expectancy. This is all with the current clinical advances in care. This then translates to about 500,000 adolescents, and I think more recent estimates up to 750 now, with chronic conditions who are expected to transfer from pediatric to adult health care per year. And we think that, you know, reaching adulthood for these children should be a triumphant milestone, but this has not been the case. Morbidity during the transfer from pediatric adult care has been extremely high for many conditions. We've seen worsening pulmonary function and cystic fibrosis, and these are all considered to be preventable. Worsening diabetes control and hospitalizations for type 1 diabetics, and loss for follow-up with patients with congenital heart disease. By the way, this is not unique to the United States. We often say, well, we lost funding. I mean, this is a major contributor, but we see this in Europe, Canada, and Australia, and they've all mirrored our system. This is an example in cystic fibrosis, and we have a little pointer here. Again, with current treatments, this should be a relative flat line, but what you do is you see this peak, and the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation has been very concerned with the fact that this is preventable. In a recent study with type 1 diabetes, this is from Deborah Lotstein in pediatrics, they looked at a multi-center study of 5-year longitudinal cohort. This is 185 youth and young adults. Over half had worsening hemoglobin A1Cs at 7.5 at baseline to 9.2 at follow-up. For clinicians, this is bad. This is not a good thing. With a 2.5 odds of worsening hemoglobin A1C when a youth is transferred out of pediatric care. If they stayed in pediatrics, they didn't have this issue. So we had a slight problem. And especially when we start thinking about moving from pediatric to adult health care, that time period in between, something's going wrong. And again, with the current technologies, this is thought to be preventable. And we really need to find ways, improve the transition process, you know, is a way to ensure high quality care across the age spectrum. That improvements in transitions of care and ensuring care in the adult health care setting, we can assume that there could be a decrease in morbidity and mortality, and that decreasing that morbidity and mortality can also decrease costs and improve the lives of our patients. So when we think about crossing that chasm, and we call that the healthcare transition process, we define that as the purposeful, planned movement of adolescents and young adults with chronic and physical and medical conditions, and I would include mental health conditions, from the child-centered to adult-oriented healthcare system. And there have been multiple consensus statements, like for the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Physicians, to transition patients to adult-focused healthcare. So again, talking about the life course, this is from Neil Halfen, but I'm not going to rehash it. We've talked about it almost at every presentation about maintaining health throughout. Again, I would argue that there is a dip right around here in the 20s. And when we think about how do you improve this, there are challenges to transitions, which really across various levels on patient, family, provider, system, and policy. So when we think about the patient, we know that the neurocognitive development has not fully matured in most adolescents, and maybe most 30 and 40-year-olds too. But that being said, patients with chronic diseases often have an abrupt expectation of age of majority to undertake their own care. We tend to treat an 18-year-old the same way we treat a 14-year-old, and then when they turn 19, you're supposed to be a 50-year-old. Pediatric patients often have the skill set subsequently to manage their own health care, and they often have a significant unmet medical need. So this comes from the National Survey of Children's Health. Thank you, Dr. Kogan, for supplying a data set. But when we, again, looking at adolescents with special health care needs, they often have many more unmet needs than office visits. And in, again, looking at unmet medical need in that bottom left-hand corner, you see that there's a significant number of adolescents. Again, you think these are healthy people, but no, 12% with an unmet medical need. So when we think about the psychosocial consequences of the transitioning, this is about a youth about, this is a qualitative study I performed. And they, we asked them, what was your first experience on an adult ward? Their first experience was how their DNR status. This is a child with a very significant complex congenital illness. And she stated it was the hardest thing to deal with because usually when you turn 18, it's fun, it's happy, I can move out, I can vote, that was cool, I could vote. That was really cool. But a normal teenager person, like a teenage person, does not have to decide how they're going to die. And unfortunately, she was never part of that conversation, how do you deal with palliative care? There's also parental challenges. Parents are often ill-prepared to navigate the adult healthcare system and adult programs. As an internist, most of them are clueless, so then trying to navigate your child is incredibly difficult. Parents also lose the legal rights of their children at age of majorities. And so then we get a change in family-centered care. We often talk about family-centered care to patient-centered. But then where does the parent come in when you talk about patient-centered care? And again, as parents age, they may not be able to care for their children. And how do we deal, especially with those with developmental disabilities, who cares for these individuals as their parents and their primary caretakers need to go into nursing homes? We also have significant provider challenges. Oftentimes, the lack of knowledge of pediatric diseases in adult medicine. There's differences in provider roles. Again, pediatrics is much more family-centered. We include the parents. We include their social structure. In adult medicine, we're often very patient-centered and family-excluded. And there's often differences in subspecialist versus primary care roles, where we have multiple, we'll talk about systems, but the role of the primary care physician oftentimes changes. We don't really have set medical homes that's just rolling out internal medicine as compared to pediatrics. And oftentimes there's poor, non-existent communication between pediatric and adult providers. This is a study we did on comfort in being a primary care provider. All of these issues on the side are conditions that any person with special health care need may accrue or be born with. And what we see on the red is sort of the very lower proportions of comfort. So as you can see in the adult issues, internists are pretty good at these conditions like chronic pain, depression, hypertension. Pediatricians, not comfortable at all in dealing with these. But when we get into the childhood onset chronic conditions, internists are really abysmal in caring or being really comfortable in treating these patients, where pediatricians are more comfortable. But when we think of a special health care need, they follow along all these columns. And so who can actually take care of them? As part of this paper, I was thinking when I wanted to publish it to have a not me variable, because about 40-50% said not me. So where do these kids go? In addition, we have challenges on a healthcare system. Funding resources differ dramatically between pediatric and adult programs, especially for orphan and rare diseases. This is not exclusive to the United States. We tend to care about our kids, not really care about us. I say us as an adult. And pediatric care is often centralized. We have disease centers. And oftentimes it's multidisciplinary. For instance, you have spina bifida clinics. Cystic fibrosis clinics just recently have their adult centers, but parents are used to multidisciplinary centers where adult care is much more fragmented. Oftentimes communities are caring for our special health care needs patients. I know as physicians, we always think, well, you know, the medical home is it. But most parent patients will say that, you know, medical care maybe is 1 to 5% of their life. 95% is in their community. But there's differences in services between agencies, and many agencies do not cross silos. Oftentimes, we have school-based programs which really support families that end between 18 and 21 years old, depending on their systems. And again, supports may be very limited. And then, so when you're in homes, you move out, and your options may be group homes, integrated communities, or institutions, depending on the state. And then when we looked at community agencies, perspectives. This is from a community provider stating, at least in the United States, we're really resource rich. It's still not enough. And these people and agencies that are supposed to help and advocate for families end up being gatekeepers. So families and providers oftentimes end up with a little bit of a friction despite trying to advocate. Finally, we talk about health policy challenges. So there's differences in funding. We have CHIP. We have Title V programs. These end abruptly at age 18 to 21. The nice thing the Affordable Care Act has done for us is expanded some of these programs so we don't see that dramatic drop at 18 to 21. In addition, rights of patients change. There are some legislation that out there that does help people with disabilities and chronic conditions, such as IDEA and American Disabilities Act, that ensure rights and integration for our special health care needs populations. But again, limited in scope, oftentimes to the workplace and schools. This is a study that we did looking at the National Survey of Children's Special Health Care Needs. Again, this is statewide estimates. It's the only one that we could use for states. And what this shows in the blue and red, not to go ahead and lean toward my political affiliation, but this was the proportion of adolescents who would be at risk for becoming uninsured at age of majority. And this is based on their current insurance status and where they lie in the federal poverty line and what the Medicaid cutoff was for their state. And what we see is in the blue, the proportion from 2.3 to 10% who would lose insurance just based on income eligibility alone. The yellow indicates from 10.1 to 20%, and the red states from 20 to 31.8%. So as you can see in the red states, just by income eligibility alone, if they were on a state program, these are the ones who at 18 to 21 would lose insurance. This is without the ACA. So taking that all into account, I'm part of the Healthcare Transition Research Consortium, and we developed a model of how we should approach healthcare transitions. Now, the bubbles here are very similar to the work that has been done, and these are all built on already other models that have been out there, because healthcare transition isn't just about treating the patient. It's treating the person in their environment. And we talk about the environmental domains of their educational supports, the community services. Oftentimes, we have to work within our healthcare system domain and our family and social supports and individual. But at least in the healthcare transition process, we also have to think about integrating in our adult healthcare services across the lifespan, from pediatric provider systems to the adult healthcare, along with the adult competencies. So while kids are growing up, we're really good at developmental milestones, but we're not really good at developing developmental milestones for their own personal autonomy, from when they become dependent on their parents to become independent. And again, some people will never become fully independent in their own healthcare. So I do challenge us all that many of these challenges we can overcome them through research, action, and policy. For example, what are individualized interventions that can be used to improve morbidity and care receipt to our patients, whether that be within transition planning, care coordination strategies. We talked about the medical home. Title V project programs have been there in terms of trying to do care coordination. I live in California. We sucked, and we're trying very hard to improve that. And I've seen it firsthand. I do urgent care. And then how can we adapt our healthcare systems to bridge the chasm between pediatric technological advances and our adult healthcare delivery system? And that's a monumental challenge, but I think it's doable. And can we adapt current service models to work with the healthcare system to meet the needs of patients and parents? And what we don't know is what is the most effective model systems of care that are out there. And what are the most critical outcome measures that ensure success as an adult? We talk about transfer. We talk about, well, yes, what are good transition outcomes? We have a lot of the core outcome measures and quality of care, but how do we know that we're transitioning our patients appropriately for the to maximize the success in both their healthcare and their lives? And what are the policies that can improve outcomes? Are there changing enrollment eligibilities, changing age out periods for those with disabilities? Do we monitor different programs in the schools? Is age 21 too short of a gap for some of these patients, especially for those with developmental disabilities? So for our next steps, I think that we still require evidence-based modalities and programs and evaluation of interventions that will allow improved care across the lifespan for children with special health care needs. We really need to solidify outcomes to measure meaningful, successful transition and transfer outcomes. And again, system-wide efforts to meet the needs of young adults with special health care needs, I think, and I will argue, will really improve health care delivery for all children and all adults in our healthcare system. And thank you.
Okay, so I failed as a moderator and we went over our time. So we have a little less than 10 minutes for questions. Anyone want to start? I certainly have a few. So for Dr. Kogan, I was wondering, do you think that the decrease in medical home access to medical home for the CSHCN population is basically because they need more care coordination than non-CSHCN, or is it a lot more complicated than that?